Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. What you're about to hear is a recording, a raw recording of a session between myself and Brandt in the USA. Brandt is a school teacher and he wants to prepare lessons aimed at white children in America, to teach them about whites in southern Africa, but also he wants to do lots of other history. So in this rough and ready session that we did, we were discussing the war between the Zulus and the Boers in 1838 and the events that led to it and what happened afterwards, and there was a massacre as well. So the two guys that you see on the screen in front of you, on the left is Andries Pretorius and on the right is Piet Retief, and they are both prominent characters in what Brandt and I are going to discuss. I just want to give a little bit of background. Piet Retief is the guy who gets killed along with a whole bunch of other people, but Andries Pretorius is a guy who comes through again and again for the Boers, and he's chosen as their leader, and he really comes through again and again. In fact, according to Wikipedia, he was the Prime Minister of Natalia Republic, and what you're going to be seeing in this video is all about the events that led to the creation of Natalia. Natalia is a Boer republic that you've never heard of. In fact, in total, I'm told that in total the Boers created at least 6 republics, maybe even as many as 10. Natalia was the one that lasted a while, and then the British came and the British and the Boers fought it out. I quite enjoy the story of Natalia because it's quite a heck of a story and it didn't last long, and then later it became known as Natal. It fell under British control and the British and the Zulus later fought it out. But I do enjoy the story of Natalia. It is quite a hell of a story from the beginning to the end. This was one of the early Boer republics that the Boers tried to create. And that guy on the left, Andries Pretorius, he went on to do other things. And the capital city of South Africa is named Pretoria, and it's named after him. So he's a pretty kick-ass guy, and it's awesome that Pretoria is named after him. And just outside Pretoria is the big monument to Blood River, and that of course was Pretorius's greatest feat. In the rest of the video you'll have these two maps in front of you. The one on the left is the Battle of Blood River, but the one on the right is the Zulu attack on all the whites, and when the Zulus went and slaughtered whites all over the show who were settling in Natal. And you'll see Vienen, spelled W-E-E-N-E-N, there on the far right, but there were a number of massacres. But I just want to mention something about this discussion that Brandt and I have. We talk quite a bit about the behavior of the blacks and how the blacks see the whites. How do other races view us? So I talk a lot about why the Zulus killed Retief and why I think the Zulus went for this strategy. But after the end of this session, I actually went and found a diary by a British missionary, because there were a couple of British Christians in the area who were aware of the massacre. And the British missionary's diary is very interesting. So at the end of this session, for a couple of minutes, I read from the British missionary's diary, and you'll see that the things that Brant and I have concluded are dead on the money. We understood exactly correctly what was going on, and you'll see what the British missionary has to say. And you'll see that the whole affair is actually much more gruesome than they write up on Wikipedia or in the histories. That if you look at what the British missionary has to say, he tells you that even white children were killed alongside Retief. But as usual, Brant and I talk about various other things, and we go a little bit off in different directions, and we discuss other white history. So the bottom line is that whites are whites, and whites behave the same way everywhere. And how the Boers went about things, and what they did, and what their morality was, and how they viewed certain things. In this particular case, the Boers get really, really angry. They absolutely lose their shit. They are totally outraged, and for a short while, the Boers behave like the Romans. I personally love it. It's one of my favorite pieces of history, and I'm actually going to do some more digging because I did cover these events and much more in another video. In my private discussions with Brant, we also just chatted about whites in America, whites in Canada, whites in Australia and New Zealand. And Brant has a lot more knowledge of some of the other countries' history. And we were just concluding, and he was pointing out that whites behave the same everywhere. So, you know, all the claptrap you've heard about white South Africans and white South Africans are this and white South Africans are that is mostly just a bunch of Jewish bullshit. It's just Jewish crap. All whites are actually very similar. You'll see all these Western European whites, the ones who went to Australia, New Zealand, Canada, etc., America, that we're actually all the same. Our methods of behavior are the same. The only thing is that in Africa, there were so few whites who came here and few whites who could survive due to disease. The big killer back then was disease, but in the century or more since then, whites solved all the disease problems, and Africa nowadays is absolutely fine. The fact that there's an enormous black population in Africa nowadays is due only to whites. You can thank whites with European medicine. Anyway, so here's the session with Brant, and don't forget to listen to the chunk at the end where I discuss the British missionary Owens.
Last thing that we talked about were the Fort Trekkers moving beyond the Drakensberg Mountains. And the first topic that we're going to talk about now is Piet Retief meeting with the Zulu King Dingaan. And I believe that Dingaan was trying to make some sort of a deal with Retief, where if Retief brought back some stolen cattle, he would receive some land or use of land or deeds for land from Dingaan, but Dingaan had Retief killed. Also during this time, the Boers started settling along the Blokrans River, and they were trying to acquire as much land as possible. And during this time, the Zulu began massacring the Boers, which led to a battle of Blokrans, and in retaliation, the Zulu murdered women and children. And then the Boers then decided to openly take on the Zulu and defeat them and to forcefully take the land. So
Okay, there's a little bit of a time issue there with the sequence in which you put your stuff there, but it's no problem. I'll correct it. I'll go through it now. Basically, what you're looking at there are the first Boers who were heading out to Natal. They were heading out to the east, and they were going to the north of Natal and they were looking for land. And if you remember, we were talking about the Drakensberg Mountains that were going from the south to the north, and you basically had one bunch of Boers setting out to the east of the Drakensberg Mountains to go and found territory to live in. And then you had other bunches of Boers who then trekked on the western side of the Drakensberg Mountains, and they settled different places. So what we're looking at here with Piet Retief is the Boers on the eastern side, closer to the ocean, who have now moved to the north. So they've moved further north, they've come out of the Cape, they've passed by the Khoisas. And the Khoisas are the southernmost tribe where those wars known as the Kaffir Wars have taken place. The whites and blacks have had a punch up there for quite a long time. But these Boers are moving north of the Khoisas, but they're running to a place where they're going to be living in a place where they are south of the Zulus. And the Zulus are the big warlike tribe that are now in the northern part of what we'd call South Africa today. So the Khoisas are the southern blacks, some of whom are merged with Khoisan, and the Zulus are the northernmost tribe.
Okay. So, which tribe did Piet Retief encounter and try to have dealings with?
He was trying to strike a deal with the Zulus who were in the north. And it seems to me that there was clearly land up there on the southern border of this Zulu kingdom, and it seems to me that there must have been land there that was pretty empty where these Boers felt that they could settle. And there is a map that I sent you which relates to the massacres, and in that map you will see that the various Boer families had already picked out areas where they had gone with their wagons and they started settling, and groups of families settled in slightly different places. And the Blaukrans River was one of several rivers there. So I get the impression that Piet Retief and this group of people had gone there and they'd already started, let's say, creating their camps, and they've got their places where they're staying, but he wants to go and negotiate with the Zulu king. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to negotiate with the Zulu king to buy, it seems he wants to buy land, and he's looking at land between certain rivers. And that is what he's going and having these meetings about, and then they come back to their wagons and they stay with their families in between. So, from what I understand about what happened here, is that when Retief went to go and talk to the Zulu king, and it seems like there were multiple meetings, it seems that the Zulu king then came up with this notion that, okay, he's willing to strike a deal and sell the land that the Boers want. He is willing to strike this deal, but he lays down a condition. And his condition is that the Boers need to go and round up some cattle. But these cattle were stolen from the Zulus by another black tribe. So the Boers have to go and find those cattle and get those cattle back from this other tribe, and then bring those cattle back. And if he does the and if the Boers do that, or the Voortrekkers do that, then Dingaan's promises that he's then going to sign this deal. So the Boers head off and they go, and it takes them some while. It takes them quite a few days, I don't know exactly how long, but it takes them a while, and because it's actually a big job, it's not just a couple of cattle. They've got to get a large herd of cattle that was stolen from these blacks. And just to remind you that for the blacks, cattle was like their gold. It was their money in that time. Cattle were important. And you're probably looking at large numbers, thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of cattle. So they had to go and find these cattle and probably have to engage and chase the black tribe away and basically steal the cattle back and bring them back. Now, that in and of itself, I just want to focus a little bit on the way that whites see themselves, because in South Africa, in Afrikaans history, the whites say, well, Retief went there and he was talking and he wanted to strike a deal, and then Dingaan, just murdered him. Okay, but the reality is that we always look at ourselves from a point of view of our failings. We look at our failings and our weaknesses. And so we say, oh, but Retief went there with good intentions. He was going to do an honest deal, etc. But you need to look at it from the viewpoint of the Zulus, who are warriors. And I'm not doing this in order to take the Zulu side. I want to make it clear that whites need to learn to look at themselves through other people's eyes, other people who could be victims of wars with us, and that we can be a threat to other people.
So do you think that Dingaan saw Pieter Retief and his people as a threat, like a military threat?
Absolutely, absolutely. When I look at this, you've got to keep in mind that the Khoisas, who are further south in Natal, the Khoisas and the Boers, or the whites, have been fighting wars known as the Kaffir Wars. They've been fighting wars for decades. They've had wars on and off for decades, where the whites are fighting the blacks in what is now the Eastern Cape. So the Eastern Cape is south of Natal. The blacks and whites have been fighting for a long time. They don't fight every day, but they've had short phases where they've fought each other over a period of time, and the whites have driven the blacks out of the Cape. So, keep in mind that it's not just the whites who are moving around and talking to people. There are also missionaries moving around and talking to people. There are blacks moving around talking to each other. So the Zulus had to have had contact with the Khoisas. They had to have known. They had to know in one way or another about the Kaffir Wars. There's no question that they must have talked to other blacks. They must have heard from other blacks about the fighting with the whites. They must have known where it's taken place. So when these Zulus see these whites pitching up with their wagons and their guns, and these whites are now coming and settling on their border, and the whites are saying, listen, we're coming here in peace and we'd like to live here next to you. I mean, those Zulus have to know, hold on, this is similar to what's happened to the Khoisas down there. There's a river, and the whites were living on the other side of the river, and the whites chased some of those people over, and the whites shot people. So the Zulus could not have had no knowledge of any of this, because this stuff has happened over decades. The blacks had to have been talking to each other. It's impossible that they could not have known. And this guy's saying, hey, look at these people. These whites are coming and they got guns. Now, here's an interesting thing is nobody addresses the question of why did Dingaan come up with this request? Why did Dingaan say, oh, by the way, okay, I'll give in to your request. I'll go with your plan. What you need to do is there are some cattle. There's a whole bunch of cattle that was stolen from our people, and you need to go and find them and get them back from the guy who stole them. So that is quite a mission. That's a military mission to say, you not only have to go and find those cattle, they're hidden somewhere, But you got to steal them back for us. Those people that you're going to steal them from are probably going to fight you. So he's actually giving the Boers a military mission. He's saying to them, you got to go and do something. You got to go and find it, hunt it down. You're going to have to fight those people, steal those cattle back, and bring those cattle to us. So why is he bringing that up? I have wondered, this is my theory. I have wondered if Dingaan set it as a requirement in the hope that the whites will fail. Because if the whites fail, then he says, look, I asked you to do this and you didn't do it. So, I can't give you that territory that you want. There's some clever diplomacy right there. But what if the Boers actually pull it off? Then he sees, hold on, these people not only went to get that stuff, they also chased and fought those blacks who had the stuff. These whites are dangerous. And, that'll just reinforce the notion that these whites are dangerous. They've got weapons, and if they can steal all those cattle back and violently take those cattle from somebody else, then I'm going to have dangerous people right on the south of my territory. So later on, then the Boers come back, and they come back with all the cattle. There's something else, by the way. The Boers didn't just come back with the cattle. There's something else that the Boers also got. I can't remember what it is now. But I remember that as part of that, they got other stuff as well. So Piet Retief went back and he boasted and he said, oh, we not only got the cattle, we also got something else. Can't remember what it was. And then Dingaan said to Retief, you got to give me that as well. So the Boers then said, oh, okay, if that's what you want, we'll give that to you as well. So the Boers not only succeeded, they succeeded beyond expectations. And then Dingaan says to him, okay, I'm going to sign this agreement with you, and we're going to have this sort of dance and celebration. But when you come, you mustn't bring your weapons. So, if you look at that kind of stuff, you got to see that Dingaan is planning ahead. Dingaan is no fool. He's planning ahead. He's done this in a nice diplomatic way to test these people. Maybe Dingaan was quite convinced that they would fail and that he could diplomatically tell them, listen, you got to go because you failed. But now instead, he finds that not only did they succeeded better than he anticipated, which just must be setting off alarm bells in his brain. And I do know that Dingaan was talking to other blacks as well. Other blacks, they were having their own discussions. So the chief wasn't just making decisions alone. He was talking to other senior blacks, etc. And they must have spoken about this. And the fact that Dingaan said to Retief, come without your weapons, I mean, that should tell it all, okay? That he knows he's gonna kill them. And the events that take place is he's basically reached the realization he's got dangerous white people there. If he strikes a deal with those white people, there are going to be future wars with those people, and he's got to get rid of them. So he that this is the way I see it when I look at the situation. And the whites are thinking in moral terms. Oh, but Retief didn't do anything wrong to Dingaan. He didn't kill any Zulus. He was nice to them. He came to them in peace. But Dingaan must be looking at this saying, I'm going to have a bunch of white people with advanced technology right on my border. They could come and wage war against me. They could invade me. They are a threat to me. So He invites them to the celebration. They start the celebration, and then at a point during the celebration, he gives the order, and they grab all these disarmed whites. My understanding is that Piet Retief brought 69 guys with him, and they were all disarmed, sort of the early version of gun-free South Africa and gun-free America. And they grab them all and they take them off to a place that the Zulus had a hill where they executed their criminals, and Retief was executed. Something I forgot to mention is, by the way, I found what might be, there might be a diary online. I can send you the link. There was a Christian missionary who apparently was a white Christian missionary who was not too far away, who actually witnessed the executions, and he wrote it in his diary. And so he's like the only white witness to this set of executions. Anyway, they were executed, and later on, I'm kind of jumping the gun, but much later on, when other Boers came after the later events, they do say that when they found the bodies of these guys on the hill, that Retief had the signed treaty on himself. So anyway, though there are people who now dispute that, but anyway. But the point is, what then happens is Dingaan not only kills Retief and his senior people there, immediately he tells his impis, which are his military units, he immediately tells his military units to go and attack the Boers, and attack the Boers there by Blokrans and Vienen and all those places, and the Zulus sweep down on them, and they attack all these Boer families, and those are the families of these guys who have come to negotiate, and they attack them, and they fight with them, and they slaughter many of them, wipe out families in their entirety, but they kill a couple of hundred whites. And so when I look at that, those events clearly speak for themselves, that the two things are linked. It's not an accident that this warrior king saw these whites as a threat, and this was his military solution. He decides, let me kill the leaders, wipe the leaders out, disarm them, wipe them out, and let's go and slaughter all their people and chase them away, and then we don't have these dangerous white people to deal with. And that very likely he probably never had any intention of ever agreeing to any of this. He knew these people are a threat. They're dangerous. White people with muskets, etc., advanced technology, these people are a threat to his tribe. And no ways was he going to accept this. That's my view on these matters.
I can't disagree with anything that you said there. I think that what you said about Dingaan being a bit crafty, being a bit clever, probably so. He must have had some skills in order to rise up to become chief. And like you said, if Retief and his men could not accomplish the task of bringing back the cattle, he could say, nope, sorry, you don't get the land. If he does bring back the cattle, he could think, wait a second, this is a formidable, competent military force, and then they want to be living on some of this land here. So I'm going to murder these people. And I think this brings up something that we see over and over again in history, and we also see with clashes of different races, between people of different strengths, between men and women, between sometimes Jews and whites, where the side that perceives itself as being weaker cannot openly fight against the side that looks like it's stronger. They have to use subterfuge. They have to use political tricks, or you could just say they lie. They straight out lie. They have to use some sort of manipulation to gain an upper hand over the side which is stronger. And I just want to point out that's something that occurs throughout history and even occurs in interpersonal conflicts.
I totally agree with you. You see this right throughout history, and you're quite right that the whites nowadays try to portray themselves as the victims, but in reality, whites never see themselves as strong. So they never look at it through the eyes of the enemy.
Right. I guess there was a person who once said you have to know yourself and know your enemy, and you know both of those, then you're ahead of the game.
Yes,
Su Sun Tzu, I suppose.
yes, Sun
Yeah,
Tzu,
awkward
Sun
pause.
Tzu.
That's right. So this was happening in 1838, if I understand correctly, and soon, sometime after this, of course, I'll have this on the lesson. We also have the Battle of Blood River.
Yes, so how this happens is that the survivors from those massacres, the message gets back to the Cape, and the horrific story is told about how they went in peace, and they were going to strike a deal, and they were talking to these blacks, and then the blacks went and slaughtered the leader and attacked everybody. This for me is one of the most fun times in Boer history. Is that these Christian Boers who are into their morality and playing by the fair rules, they are absolutely outraged out of their minds by the killing of Retief and these massacres, and they see it as such a dirty, low down trick by this tribe of blacks, and they are absolutely horrified and angry. And for the first time, and probably the only time in Boer history, they are so outraged that they decide, you know what, we're going to go back and we're going to clobber those Zulus. We're going to go and kick those Zulus' asses for the despicable behavior that they engaged in. They killed our people, they lied to us, they cheated us, they killed our people after we went so nicely and honestly. And this is where they gather together the people that are going to go forward, led by a guy called Andries Pretorius, and they start forming the next trek, but this trek is a military trek, and they're gathering the men and women, but they're arming themselves up. And
Okay, well, let me ask. Hey, Jan, if it's a military trek, retribution in the style of ancient Rome, why would they be taking their women with them? Is this like a permanent move slash military operation, do you think, or just military?
well, they clearly are going to stay somewhere. I haven't really thought that through, but I assume that they got to take their women and children with them because it's going to be long. In our last
Okay.
discussion, we did mention that it's a very long period of time, and possibly they're still going to settle there. I think, now that I think about it, I think that I have read that their goal was to go back, crush the Zulus, and live there anyway. That was their goal. So now they're going to go back, and they are going to live there, whether the Zulus like it or not. And so they gather all their people together, and they remember these things are privately financed. So these people are privately financed, and they have to buy up their weaponry, buy up all their stuff. And interestingly enough, what is very fascinating about Blood River is that these whites actually buy two small cannons. And one of those cannons is actually up in Pretoria in that monument. And I've seen it. It's a little cannon. It's probably about 2.5 feet high. And that little cannon was a weapon of mass destruction for its day. So, more advanced white technology that they're taking with them. They're not just taking muskets, they're taking two cannons with them. And yeah, so So Andres Pretorius is chosen to be the leader, and they gather the thing together and off they go, and they head to the north. I think they also are accompanied by some blacks. There are some blacks who go along with them who are their servants, etc. And as they go to the north, their goal is actually to get to the Zulu, what you could call the Zulu capital. And they're going to go to the Zulu capital and they're going to crush the Zulus, kick their asses, and then that's their plan. But on their way there, the Zulus are already, again, the Zulus are a military tribe, they are a warrior tribe. We haven't spoken about the fact that the Zulus by this time have had a lot of military experience. There's the Zulu Empire, which we haven't discussed. And the Zulu Empire has already been created. This is already 10 or more years after that. So the Zulus have got lots of military experience. And the Zulus clearly are scouting out and checking things out. And the Zulus realize that here is a Boer force coming. And they prepare an army of 15,000 men who are going to go and fight these whites. And so the two groups come close. And the Boers then realize that there's a Zulu army, and that is when Pretorius decides to find a place for them to lager, to set up their defensive positions with their wagons, and he chooses this particular location along this river where the one side is bordered by a river and the other side by what is known as a donga, which is a ravine. And so that limits the blacks and their ability to attack. And so he forms up the positions there. And then the blacks decide to come and attack. And they make a number of mistakes. The blacks are all supposed to get ready for the attack in an early morning, but only half of the blacks have crossed the river and the other half haven't. And so, so one of the questions is, is there some black inefficiency at work here? Their commander had told them that they must get ready for the attack the next day, and only half of them are across the river by the morning. And the military decision, in this case, the bad military decision, is made that they're going to attack the Boers anyway, even though half of their guys are still on the other side of the river. And they're trying to cross at about three different spots. And so this works in favor of the whites. Either it's bad black decisions or bad black efficiency along with a bad black decision. But clearly the black commander is feeling comfortable that even with half of the troops, that he still is able to outnumber them, and he's clearly confident that he can still take them. So he launches his attacks, and these attacks are driven off. These lagers, I believe, the Boers had a lot of practice in setting up their lagers. They also have like thorn bushes and all kinds of things that they ram in there to make it it's almost like the Romans with their little Roman forts that they do on the march, except these are forts created by wagons, and they quickly sort of have like a little entrance and so forth. Not as sophisticated as the Romans, but still a good thing. And they're able to shoot back at them while these Zulus are trying to throw spears or trying to get through. And then they've got these cannons. So the blacks attack in various waves, and the waves are repulsed. And the blacks take heavy casualties. Other blacks try to cross at other places. And the fighting goes on the whole day. My understanding is that by late in the afternoon, the whites are actually running out of ammunition. So the whites maybe even didn't expect to be fighting as much as they did.
Well, they were attacked by a much larger force, right? Was the blacks had about 15,000 on the day, is that right?
Yes, the Black Army was at least 15,000. There are different numbers that people have said, but there was at least 15,000. I'm not sure if there are other sources that have said more than 15,000, but yeah, the whites weren't that many, and yeah, so the whites got a heavy fight there. Thank goodness they had those little cannons. Those cannons must have been very interesting, because that would be like it would be like a seriously advanced piece of weaponry there, and very useful, very useful. And so later in the afternoon, that is when Pretorius, I believe, launched a cavalry attack. And I think he launched the cavalry attack to try and break up the Zulus, and they broke them up into two forces. And they were only like 300 men on horseback. And I believe that they killed at least 3,000 Zulus, but I have heard it said that 10,000 Zulus were killed. I'm not sure which is the exact number, but the bottom line is that for such a small force of whites, they punched way above their weight level, as usual.
Right. The Boers could ride and fire at the same time, couldn't they, from horseback? Is that correct?
I'm not sure in the days of the muskets.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, not during that time period, right? You're going to get one shot
Yeah,
from your musket.
they could probably have done it, but I'd imagine that they'd be very careful. One of the things you need to keep in mind is that the Boers had to be very careful with their ammunition, even in full-scale wars. And that's something we'll discuss in other wars. So they are very careful. They probably are very careful with their ammunition.
Right. If you're talking about a battle that's taking several hours from early morning into the afternoon, they have single shot rifles. I assume the women and or children are reloading the rifles and handing them a loaded rifle as they're, looking out through the logger and keeping up a constant rate of fire. They must have gone through a tremendous amount of ammunition and wondering if they were going to run out.
Yeah, there's some white teamwork there.
Absolutely. Some practice. Some families that are sticking together, practicing together and fighting together and sticking together there. So, since it's called the Battle of Blood River, where did that get its name? Where did it get that title?
The name comes from the fact that there was so much blood in the river, probably from those blacks who were trying all day to cross the river, that the red of their blood, was very
Okay.
obvious in the river. So yeah.
Do you know if this broke the spirit of the Zulu nation at that time, or did it knock them back on their heels?
I think it probably knocked them back on their heels, but they weren't fully finished. And this is where it gets really interesting, is that there were Zulus who weren't in favor of fighting the whites. There's a guy in particular, his name is, I think, Mpandi or something along those lines. But there was a senior guy on the black side who was, I'm not sure if he was like a half, if he was partly related to the Zulu king, like a distant relative, but he had a high rank. I think his name is an Mpandi or something along those lines. And he didn't want to fight the whites. So what actually happened is that these Boers later met up with these Zulus, these, let's call them the friendly Zulus or the peace faction, and
Okay.
they struck a deal, and they struck a deal that the Boers would work with that faction, and they would destroy Dingaan, and then after destroying Dingaan, then Mpandi would become the leader of the Zulus. So they agree on this. They agree to actually cooperate. And by the way, a lot of this stuff, as you should see, goes quite contrary to the liberal narrative. You don't have to be nice to people in order to strike deals with them. You just have to be strong. If you've got enough military, if you've got enough firearms and they're afraid of you, they'll come and talk to you and say, hey, please don't kill us. We'd like to strike a deal. We would like to strike a deal with you. And that's actually what happened with in this case. And so these Zulus, it's quite funny because once the Boers had agreed, okay, we'll work with you, we're going to go with you to attack the other side. Believe it or not, the peace-loving Zulus, they are so confident of themselves now that they know that they've got white backup, that they actually head out to go and attack the other Zulus, and they have a battle with them and they defeat them. So the peacenik Zulus defeat the other side of the other side, and they're already winning the battle. The whites are sluggishly coming along. The whites aren't even part of the battle. Believe it or not, the Boers are actually busy stealing cattle. The Boers are busy stealing Zulu cattle as they are advancing. I think that the Boers stole something like 40,000 cattle, and nobody complained about it. And they stole 40,000 cattle, and they were there to sort of be the moral support for this guy. And Dingaan is thrown out; he's tossed out of power. This other guy comes to power, and basically, the Boers have engaged in regime change. To use
Okay,
modern terminology.
and so the peace faction of the Zulus defeat Dingaan's faction, and
Yes.
they do it without the Boers actually being in the battle, but they have so much confidence that they think the Boers are going to back them up that they go all in and win the fight.
Something along those lines. There is a video that I've done that I'll send to you where I go into a lot more detail. I did it a few years ago, and you'll hear the same story in more detail. But yes, something along those lines. So now the Boers have engaged in regime change, and the Boers are settling in Natal, and they no longer need to strike any deals with anybody. They're now buddies. And that is when they also create the Republic of Natalia. They create a Boer Republic, and yeah, problem solved. Natalia lasts a couple of years, but we can probably come and revisit that because the British come back and actually take Natalia a couple of years later. But for a couple of years, the Boers actually have a republic in northern Natal, and they are living quite happily.
Interesting. And they were living peacefully with the new Zulu under the new leadership during
Yeah,
that time period. Okay.
absolutely. They don't have any other problems with the Zulus, as far as I know. What really ends it are the British, but maybe we'll discuss that in the next section because I need to just update my information on that and just double check that. But yeah, this in a nut case, and this is actually the cool part about Blood River. They don't tell you. They don't tell you all this other cool stuff. Oh, and by the way, the Boers walk away with 40,000 cattle, and nobody complains about that. So that is like the coolest part. When the Boers are like really angry, they're going to kick someone's butt, steal their cattle, destroy the other people, and now they're happy. Done by Christians. All because they're pissed off about the killing of Retief and the massacre of those others. So for a short while, they behave like the Romans.
Yeah, I suppose so. And I think that points that meeting with Retief and Dingaan that points to the different the biospirits there, because possibly Dingaan, he could not have calculated how many other whites there would have been down in the Cape Colony, how upset they would have been, and how they would have been set on retribution. Because to white people, to Western kind, you don't break the rules. I mean, these are the rules that we live by. You honor the rules. You don't just murder people when they're entering a business negotiation with you. So maybe he couldn't have seen that far ahead as to what was going to be the ramifications from murdering these people, even though to him at that time that was the most expedient thing to do.
Yes, I agree with you. And remember these Zulus by this time, they've already created the Zulu Empire, which is really stretched out of South Africa, which we'll discuss later. And they have conquered many other blacks. And that's how they deal with the blacks. They go and they kill them. And another thing is another thing that I must clarify is also that you really got to get this. People really have forgotten about this stuff. Is that in all these wars, the blacks don't just kill the enemy troops, they also kill civilians. There's no such thing as, oh, I only fight the armed guys and I leave the women and children alone. The blacks, on many occasions, not only kill the opposing blacks, they go and slaughter their families and things as well. And they obviously are looking at it from the point of view of a warrior. They've done this to other blacks. They've crushed other blacks. They've smashed them into the ground. And that's how you do it. You're going to kill everybody and you even kill their women and children. And it sends a message. It sends a firm message to the other side and it scares them. And so he might well have said to himself, look, if we go and we kill their leaders and we smash all their people, that'll teach them a lesson and they won't dare to come back. And they didn't figure that these whites will react in a totally different way. That not only are they not scared, they'll come back with even greater force and they'll come and smash you, which, by the way, is a very Roman thing. The Romans, never allowed anybody to believe that they could defeat them, and that they'd just cower. That if the Romans lose a battle, if someone kicks the Romans' asses, the Romans make sure they go back and kick their asses. And in this case, it just happened to work out like that, sort of by accident, in a sense. Just the Christian morality infuriated them to such a degree.
Well, I would say that underneath the Christian morality is the white morality, the Western kind morality, and Christianity or any philosophy is a template, is another layer set on top of what they already are. So whether they were Christian or not, in that case, they had a job that they felt they needed to get done. That's what I would assume.
I would agree with that because there is the biological side of our people. You're quite right. And I like that the layering, that yes, there's the layering on top of it, but deep down inside the animal is the same animal that it is everywhere.
Indeed. All right. Do you want to stop there as far as the amount of information to cover today?
Yeah, we can call it quits on no, we can finish off those other questions of yours.
Okay, all right.
Let's finish
So,
them off. It's not
okay,
that
so I've
it's
got
not too
these.
long.
All right, so the Retief and the Battle of Blood River, massacring the Boers at Blokrans, this was in 1838. And the Republic of Natalia is set up. And then the next thing I have down in notes is that in 1852, the Boers are setting up the Orange Free State as they cross the Orange and Vaal rivers.
Okay.
I don't suppose that there's any killing that was necessary for that.
There's nothing in particular that I know about that, so my knowledge, I assume that that I assume that was relatively peaceful.
Okay. And then in 1854, 2 years later, they set up the Transvaal, which is the South African Republic. And
Yes. Now that we will need to later talk about the other side of this. There was violence required in order for the Boers to get into that territory. The territory, I'll just quickly summarize a few things, which we'll go into more later, is that in with regard to the Orange Free State, but especially what became known as the Transvaal, that the Zulus had in earlier years wiped out the blacks who lived in the Transvaal. So that is where these Boers or the Voortrekkers got the notion that from their travels they had seen that these places are literally empty, that there's nobody there. And so that's what also gave them the impetus to say, well, we can go on the western side of the Drakensberg Mountains, we can go past the Free State and even further north in what is now the Transvaal, we can settle there. There aren't that many people there. There are some people, but not many. And we will discuss that in more detail next time. But yes, at a point, there is a bit of fighting there, and then they set up the Transvaal Republic.
All right. Now, the Transvaal Republic happens to be some very, very valuable land because what's in the ground there? And diamonds and gold were both found.
But the Boers don't know that. Nobody knows it at that point.
not at that point. Okay, so should we go to 1871 at the Hope Diamond?
Yes.
What was it? Okay. So 1854, they set up the Transvaal Republic. 1871, there's a town called Hopetown. And a couple of bored kids find a large diamond, which is later called the Hope Diamond. The British saw the possible money to be made. If there's that diamond there, then there's definitely other ones under the ground. The British annexed the territory, changed the name of Hopetown to Kimberley, which was the name of the colonial secretary at the time, in Cape Town. And the Boers were not in a position to do anything about it. They weren't strong enough to do anything at that moment.
Yes, that's true. That's true. My understanding is that they didn't just find one diamond. They found multiple. There was more and more evidence of things that they were finding. And I think, let me just check. Let's check what year they found. Oh, okay. Now this happened later. The Cullinan Diamond happened a lot later. But there were also prospectors who were moving around, and they were also looking, and they started finding gold, and there was just more and more evidence, because the process started even earlier than 1871. It already started in 1866, and they were finding different things. They found a diamond in 1866, another one in 1869, and so on. And so as the evidence grows, and also as prospectors are moving around, it's not just diamonds. There are prospectors who are looking for gold. And as the evidence builds up, you know, then you start getting the diamond rushes and the gold rushes.
Okay. And I guess one of the things that we haven't talked about too much is the entrance of the British into South African territory, because we have been talking about the Boers and the Voortrekkers almost exclusively in the as far as who's Western kind there. Do you want to say anything about when the British started showing up, or the British aggressiveness, or the British interest in that territory?
No, we can talk about that for the first Anglo-Boer War, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, it fits in pretty well. Okay.
But
all right.
The bottom line is that they start with these diamond rushes, and people start digging, and people start splitting up these places where the diamonds are, and they start And you start finding people pouring in along with those who are pouring in are people like Cecil John Rhodes from Britain. And you also get various Jews who start pitching up. And one of Cecil Rhodes's close friends is a guy called Barney Barnato, and he becomes a very important guy. But when I look at his background, they don't say he's Jewish, but he was born as Barnett Isaacs. That was his original name. He was born in London, and he's the son of Isaac and Lee Isaacs, and he's educated by Moses Angel at the Jews Free School. So he really seems to be a Jew, but there are others. I know that German Jews also pour in and they are getting involved, and the Rothschilds start getting involved. And initially it's a free for all with individual people buying these little plots and mining them. But as time goes by, the richer guys come in, they start buying up everything, and eventually it turns into a commercial operation. Basically, it becomes monopolized by the rich. And Cecil Rhodes is the key player in here, but Jews are pouring in. And Cecil Rhodes is also the agent for Rothschild. But all these sides, eventually the small guy gets driven out and the big corporates take over. And you get Barney Barnato with Barnato Diamond Mining Company. And you get, I forget the name of the company that Cecil Rhodes formed.
I see. And one other thing I want to add as far as geography goes, I think that Hopetown got renamed Kimberley, and then that's right on the edge of the Orange Free State, right on the western edge.
Yes,
So, I'm okay.
it's the borders. There were probably no formal borders, or the formal borders were still very vague. So yeah, the British probably stole a chunk of stuff that really belonged to the Free State. But the problem that then occurs is that in the years that go by, is that they start discovering diamonds and gold in actual Boer territory, which is genuinely Boer territory, and they start discovering gold and stuff up near Pretoria in what is now Johannesburg. So, the British may have been able to pull a fast one with Hopetown and Kimberley, but later they can't pull fast ones because it's very obviously not their territory. So that
Got it.
is where the next wars come from.
Yeah. Okay. So there's just a couple things that I want to say about that. If there were so-called primitive, semi-nomadic, Hottentots, Khoi, and so on, people around that area, and they saw diamonds, I wonder if they would pick up the diamonds, or if they saw gold that was at the surface, would they do anything with it, or would they look at it and say, "Oh, that's pretty, but I don't have a use for this," and then just move on? Or were there never enough people there to actually discover that and start to exploit or and dig around in that area? It's just curious that, the Earth is about 4.6 billion years old since it's, estimated since it cooled down. And we had Pangaea, and the continents broke apart and moved all over the planet, and this stuff has come up to the surface. And just in 1871, these kids pick up this big diamond in South Africa. It's interesting.
I'm with you. I'm with you. My answer to that is that it is very likely that the blacks have seen these things, and they have no conception of Western civilization. So they'd see a pretty stone, but the stone has no meaning for them. There are many things that they see that have no meaning for them. In fact, what I can add to this is that land had no meaning to the blacks. in Africa. If you really look at it, you'll see that land had virtually no value to the blacks at the time, because there are a number of occasions where whites came and dealt with blacks for land, and they struck deals with them for land. And most of the time, there were blacks who would say, "Well, you know, yeah, sure, you give us those things, and yeah, you can have that land," and they're not hassled by it. And when we get to Zimbabwe and Rhodesia, we can discuss that. Blacks did not see, there were lots of things that the blacks did not see as having value, including land itself. And if whites came and said to them, "Listen, we'll give you guns and this and that and all these things, and all we want is this piece of land," the blacks are probably like, "Yeah, sure. You know, these dummies want to give us stuff, and yeah, you can have it because there's tons of land. There's insane amounts of land around." So in the case of the diamonds, it is, I think it's white children who play with these diamonds, and then another white guy looks at that stone and he says, you know, the guy didn't even think it was a diamond. He thought it was something else. And I read that, you know, he had to send it to somebody who sent it to somebody else. And then they thought it was maybe some kind of other mineral. And only later did somebody, after a long time, did another white guy come back and say, "Yeah, you know, that thing's actually a freaking diamond. That's actually a huge freaking diamond that you got there, and I'll buy it from you for this amount of money." So you're quite right that the values, what is of value in European civilization, may have no value to the blacks. So, for example, for the blacks, what is money? Cattle are money for the blacks. That is something the blacks really valued, was cattle. So the giving and the buying and selling or stealing and acquiring of cattle, that has value to them. And my understanding is that blacks also didn't see cattle, that they saw cattle as like a $1 note. That it doesn't matter if it's a fat cow or a thin cow, it's $1. Okay?
Okay.
So those are the kinds of things that I understand about the blacks and cattle. So all they care about is the number of cattle. And yeah, I got 10,000 cattle. Whether I got 10,000 fat cattle and you got 10,000 thin cattle, we're equal. You know, that was sort of how they existed. Of course, there are many fascinating things one could ask, you know, because these people didn't have number systems, so they probably couldn't count their cattle, but at least they know they got like a whole bunch of them, you know, because I
Right.
know of nothing about number systems in their stuff. They didn't even have writing, you know. White missionaries came and took their languages and started creating dictionaries and trying to write it down. All of that was done by whites.
Yeah, I would have supposed that they had a probably a fairly limited vocabulary as well compared to Europeans. Because I think people's, whether they have a written language or not, how far ahead they have to plan into the future for their buildings, or do they want to grow crops? Do they have to domesticate animals? Do they need to have a number system like you're talking about? If they don't have all these forces on them, if they're always in warm weather where they never have to prepare for the wintertime, and whatever their food is going to have two growing seasons when it comes out of the ground. And they know how far away their livestock are. They know where they are. Their livestock has food. And if there's some other animals they're going to hunt, if they know how to hunt them, I mean, that's it. You don't ever have to plan for anything beyond that. So you don't ever have these evolutionary pressures to become advanced beyond that point. You're not going to have muskets. You're not going to have diamond cutting. You're not going to use gold in later on in electronics or anything else.
Yeah,
It's interesting.
these are good points, because these blacks, like the Zulus and other blacks, they would go to a place and they had a special kind of farming, slash and burn. They just go cut down the trees, burn the stuff, and then they'd make their little fields and plant their crops there, but they'd only be able to have crops there for a couple of years. And so they move their capital city. They move their city when they need new land. So that's also why they don't see land as an issue. So they can plant crops there for 5 years. By the fourth and the fifth year, their crops are totally sucking. And then they decide, okay, let's go live somewhere else. And then they pack their bags and they go find another place, and they go and they build their huts in a new location. So, the concept of them living in the same place for even 20 years or 100 years is something they don't conceive of, and they don't know about it. I once, many years ago in the 1980s, I actually bought a book, and I'm so sad that I probably got rid of the book. I bought a book about the Zulus as a tribe, and it was a bit of a liberal book, but it was quite an interesting book, and I read up about the Zulus and especially about Chaka. And it was very interesting how the Zulus interacted with whites. And there were other whites that came. There was also a Frenchman from the Napoleonic Wars who also befriended them. And Chaka was quite friendly to the Queen. He actually sent things to the Queen. He kind of respected the strength of the British, and he said he wanted to be friends with them, but he had no real idea of how they actually live in this land far away across the ocean. So there were clearly concepts that he didn't grasp. When the whites and the blacks are meeting in Africa, and this is no doubt the same as the whites meeting the Indians in South America, North America, etc. When the whites and blacks are meeting in Africa, it's maybe like people coming from another planet, eh? It's like here are the aliens, they're coming down, this is their ships, and they got all these fancy strange weapons that we've never seen before, this thing that makes a noise and then you drop dead, and that kind of stuff. And you've got cultures that have got nothing in common. They've got no common background. And the way they think, the way they talk, the way they do things. And that's another thing maybe that I should just add is that, for example, I remember learning at school, for example, in Rhodesia, the teacher said to us that, in white civilization, the woman, the man lets the woman go first. It's polite for a man to let a woman go first. But in black culture, that's not the way they do it. In black culture, the man goes first. And the reason the man goes first is because he's there to protect them due to danger. So their thinking is different, their reasons are different. And you are looking at people who have nothing in common. They've got nothing at all in common, and like you say, they've only developed up to the point that they needed to, because if they do certain things, that's all they need to do. They don't have to go further. They don't have to
Right.
invent anything further. You're quite right. And now they meet these small groups of strange people with light skin, and it takes them a little while. They realize that these people are pretty dangerous. They got some pretty fancy magic shit there,
Yeah, so I suppose that any technology which is pretty far advanced beyond what you could imagine, it would seem like it's magic, and you would want to get your hands on some of that if you were a tribal leader.
Absolutely. And in other things we'll discuss, we'll talk about actual examples of what the blacks asked for. So I think that's pretty much as I can say for today.
All right. All right, we'll end it there then.
I just want to read a few sentences from the diary of the British missionary Owen. There is a lot that one can say, but I'm just going to be brief and just focus on the slaughter of Peter Retief and the people with him. Owens realizes that the Boers have been slaughtered, and then there's mention about the interpreter. The Boers had an interpreter, but the interpreter is nowhere to be seen. So he describes what the blacks tell him. They said that William, as well as Mr. Hully, my own interpreter, were not there, and that Thos Halstead, the Boers' interpreter, was at Captain Gardner's, a palpable lie, for he was here when the messenger left on Sunday evening, and I tremble to say is now amongst the number of the slain. So the natives say, though Dingaan's servant this morning informed me he was not to be killed. So let me just pause there. Clearly, Owen has got servants, and the servants are telling him that the interpreter is dead. But then Dingaan, the king of the Zulus, his servant says that the interpreter was not supposed to have been killed. So, in other words, the black official says one thing, but the other blacks, the common blacks, say something else. Then in another section it says, on Mr. V's arrival, he was surprised to see the Boer guns under the trees and the natives, the blacks, handling them freely, but they themselves not to be found, but described as having gone a hunting, etc. At length, Thalela, the Induna, and Induna's like a rank that the Zulus have. The Induna told him that the Boers were killed. So he tells another white guy that the Boers had been killed. After it seems they had first been lying that the Boers had gone hunting. Gone hunting but left all their weapons behind. Anyway, Mr. Venable made no reply, and the savage, remorseless Induna asked him if he did not thank the king for having killed them. So it seems that the Induna expected the British guy to go and thank the king for killing the Boers. These missionaries are here and they're teaching the blacks. But notice what the blacks are interested in. And this is a recurring theme that you'll find with the blacks over and over again in Africa. We will discuss this more when we discuss Rhodesia. So this guy is talking to the Englishman, and it says, before this conversation, Mr. V had told him, the Induna, for what purpose he had come to see the king, and Thalela had asked him what they wanted to teach, being told the book. So they're going to be teaching the blacks either reading or writing or the Bible. And then the Induna asks, cannot you teach us to shoot or to ride? So he's more interested in the Zulus being taught how to shoot or to ride horses than in learning about the book. And then Owens later writes, our conversation has been partly on the wisest course to be adopted in the present exigency. We agree that we have no security for life. In other words, the missionaries are worried that the Zulu king could turn around and have them killed. Then Owen writes, the man who brings our milk informs us that the army, meaning the Zulu army, went out today against the Boers. We tremble for the result. So that is on the day when the Zulus attack all the other white families and slaughter them. That is in the massacres that follow. Then on another day, Owens has another discussion with the Zulus, where the Zulus explain that they will kill the Amaboro, who are the Boers, but they won't kill the British. So he says this, in the morning, two indunas with an attendant called. One of them patted his breast, a common gesticulation of friendship. No induna had ever been to the station before, and they asked to see the hut, wagon, etc. They were remarkably civil. They had been sent by the king to inform me that it was not his intention to kill either me or the other missionaries, for we had come to his country by the fews and fews. Now, what that is few, spelt F-E-W, F-E-W-S. So he's using it in plural, but he's meaning few, that only small numbers of these missionaries had come to his country. He could live in peace with us, for we were his people. All George's people, meaning the British, were his. That is, he liked them. But the Amaboro were not his people, nor were they George's. He said that all the armies that came into his country should be killed, that the Amaboro Boers were going to kill the king. They had come like an army and had fallen into a passion with him. Many other causes were then assigned for their slaughter. So it seems that these two indunas sent by the king of the Zulus now come to explain that the Zulus are not going to kill the British, but they killed the Boers because the Boers come like an army. Which I have no problem with. That is a fact. The whites were defending themselves. But now it seems that they go into a bunch of diplomatic claptrap and various nonsense to now give the reasons why they killed the Boers. I think it's really no more simple than the fact that they saw the Boers as a threat, and that should be quite clear from even this. So the other reasons, I don't take it too seriously. So the guy says, as that they had not brought Cinconiela and his people prisoners. These might be prisoners or others that the Boers had captured when they went to grab the cattle. So Owens continues, some of the other reasons I could not well understand, nor did I trouble myself about them, as there was but one true reason, the dread of their power, and that the whole was a premeditated, preconcerted plan of Dingaan, who was anxious to see, in order that he might butcher them all at once. I cannot now have a reasonable doubt, though I could not imagine previously that his designs were so treacherous. The thought frequently entered my mind, but I rejected it. I said little in reply to the king. I remarked that I had come into his country only to teach the book, that I was not a fighting person, as those who taught the book in my country did not handle the gun. The book being the Bible, of course. But it's very clear that the British missionary Owens, despite all this diplomacy from the Zulus, that Owens has concluded that the real reason the Boers were killed was because the Zulus feared their power. It's that simple. And that's exactly what I've been saying. These are my own conclusions as well. So I'm just going to read it again, where he says, some of the other reasons I could not well understand, nor did I trouble myself about them, as there was but one true reason, the dread of their power, and that the whole was a premeditated, preconcerted plan of Dingaan, who was anxious to see in order that he might butcher them all at once. I cannot now have a reasonable doubt, though I could not imagine previously that his designs were so treacherous. The thought frequently entered my mind, but I rejected it. So what Owens is saying is that he'd wondered many times whether Dingaan could be so treacherous and devious, and he'd thought about it, but he'd rejected it time and time again. But now it's absolutely crystal clear that Dingaan had planned this all along. And finally, Owens, in his diary, then tells some more of the hideous killing that took place the day before, because Piet Retief had 69 people with him. So now Owens writes, "I did not give an adequate description of the dreadful carnage yesterday. I omitted to state that many of the Boers had children with them, some under 11 years of age, as I am informed, as all these were all butchered. They also had their Hottentot servants, and these were likewise slaughtered, besides their interpreter and his servant. The number of slain must have been nearer 100 than 60. But if there had been 1,000, it would have been all the same." I suspect that he is horrified by the carnage. There are a few other points that I'm going to put in here quickly from Owens's diary, because it tells you a bit more about the Zulus, the Zulu king, and these blacks, how they are thinking and how they are behaving. Because you will see that these people are not in any way, shape, or form these noble savages who live in peace and the white man is evil and only the white man kills, and they were living all happily ever after until the white man came along and slaughtered them. No, these people have got power of their own, and these people want to kill others, and these people are looking for power, which is something that I've mentioned before when I discussed Nietzsche and will to power. So, for example, here is what Owens writes. "Dingaan afterwards sent for Mr. Venable and his interpreter." So he's asking for an Englishman to come and see him, another missionary. "He set the latter to unhalter some of his newly acquired horses, which were knee-haltered. As he never possessed a horse before, none of his own people were as yet adequate to this office." So you see, here are these blacks acquiring horses, which they must have got from the Boers or somebody else. They definitely got these things from whites. "The usual messenger who comes to the station was thrown yesterday and seriously injured. Nevertheless, he was obliged to come this morning, though apparently in great pain." So one of the black messengers tried to ride a horse, and he was thrown off the horse and seriously injured. Then Owens writes about how hot it was that day, and he then says the following: "In the evening, Mr. Venable went down again to the king. He professed that he had given orders that Toss Halstead," I don't know whether it's an abbreviation, this Toss, but anyway, "Halstead, the Boer's interpreter, should be saved, but his people were not able to distinguish him." So this is what Owens concludes. "This is Dingaan's usual method when he does a thing of which he is ashamed. He throws the odium of it upon his people." Anyway, so that gives you the British missionary's account of things, and you can get some interesting information and clues from that. Plus, the fact is that they didn't just slaughter those Boers. The Boers even had some children with them. They even had some Hottentot servants with them. And Dingaan slaughtered the whole lot. So he even killed white children who were with Piet Retief. And Owens estimates that about 100 people were killed all in all. So I just wanted to conclude with that information, because It should be as clear as daylight to you that the reason that Dingaan did this was because he thought that by smashing the Boers, smashing them soundly, that this would sort them out, they'd run away, they'd go away, they'd never come back, and that this is what he's used to. These blacks are used to doing this. They do this to all their enemies, all these blacks. They functioned like this in Africa. Forget all this noble, savage claptrap and all this nonsense that these blacks are all peaceful and sweet and they were all living happy, peaceful lives for millions of years and then the white people came and stuffed it up. No, none of that is true. They were busy slaughtering each other and torturing each other and butchering each other in ways that will make your jaw drop, I tell you. The common method for the Zulus to really punish people when they really wanted to punish people in a cruel way was for them to take pieces of wood, sharpen them, and then hit them up the rectum of their victims. So they'd knock these sharp pieces of wood up into the rectums and into the stomachs of their victims, and they lie there screaming in pain because it takes them a couple of days to die. And that is their standard way when they really want to punish people in a nasty way. And they killed lots of blacks in that way. These people, if you think that European morality and all that, that the blacks were better than that, no, you are so wrong. Anyway, so that's the information from Owens, the British missionary, and that will give you some idea of that horrible day.
And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.